From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's been 25 years since the Temptations had their first number one hit. Last month, they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Otis Williams, who organized the group and still sings with the Temptations. Also today, we talk with photographer Robert Adams. His camera captures the American West, both as it was and as it is, changed by development and pollution. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Manhattans, and book critic John Leonard reviews the latest novel from E.L. Doctorow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. We expected to be joined today by Smokey Robinson, who helped define the Motown sound through his singing, songwriting, and production, but he's not feeling well and couldn't make it to Fresh Air. So instead, we're going to feature an interview from last September with Otis Williams, the founder of The Temptations, the Motown vocal group that was just inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Some of their biggest hits were written and produced by Smokey Robinson, including this one.
When it's cold outside, I've got the month of May.
My Girl was the first Temptations song that made it to number one on both the R&B and pop charts. The Temptations were one of the most successful groups on the Motown record label. They had great voices, great harmonies, cool clothes, and flashy dance moves. Otis Williams kept the group going long after the departure of their lead singers, David Ruffin and Eddie Kendricks. The Temptations have sung through the stylistic changes of the decades. Otis Williams has written an autobiography. It's titled Temptations. Welcome.
Thank you.
Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You point out in your group the Temptations were subtler and more romantic than a lot of the other guys, and that there was no sweating or grunting on the stage. So I want to ask you how you think that was reflected in your songs and in your style on stage.
Well, I think that Paul Williams, who was one of the original members, he always believed in us trying to convey selling sex as well as keeping the class. And I wish I could take credit for not sweating, but him and I especially were sweaters. But we always tried to do things in a top-notch fashion. And
well, you say in your book that you always thought about image. Even when you were in high school and you were singing in the halls and singing at dances, you thought about image.
It's very important, you know, because when you're dealing with the public, it's always nice to set a very good impression. And we tried to do that with a very good image, a wholesome image and what have you. So that has always been one of our main criteria for trying to stay that kind of way, because it's so important.
Berry Gordy, the head of Motown Records, liked your singing, liked your style, and finally signed you to Motown Records. Did he tell you once he took you in what he had in mind for the group, changes he wanted to make?
Not necessarily. Berry was more or less into the record end of it. You know, people like Charlie Atkins, Lon Fontaine, Maurice King, and Johnny Allen, they would be the guys that would polish and mold and refine as far as the stage and the image and things of that nature. Berry was very concerned about the record end of it. Now, not to say that he didn't care how we went out, you know, and looked, because we were part of Motown and all under his auspices, but he was very into the creative end of it more so than anything else, and he left that up. That's why artist development came to be, because of he knew that he had to have somebody that I got all these talented artists here, the Supremes, the Four Tops, the Temptations, Martha and the Vandellas, the Miracles. Somebody needs to come in there and refine and polish them, so we wouldn't be just like everybody else and knew how to get on and off the stage while we were on stage.
Now, you said that Gordy really had more respect for producers and writers than he did for the performers. And I'd like to know what you meant by that, some examples of that.
Well, he had respect for the artists, but, you know, like I said, being a creative person, you know, he was very into, like, songs, because that's what he was really noted for, because he was a songwriter first, because he wrote songs for Jackie Wilson and Marv Johnson, Barrett Strong. And so I guess he was kind of partial to the producers and to the songwriters to make sure that whatever was being produced at Motown, it was done with the right kind of ingredient, with the right kind of song structure, which he always stressed, and make sure that the lyrics had meaning and where people could really identify and say, oh, yeah, I know what they're talking about. I've lived that. That's touched me before.
But in terms of the lack of power that the acts themselves sometimes had, you describe how if a group didn't show up in the studio on time for their recording date, he'd have another group come in and record the song.
Well, that's true. We had that happen to us with Do You Love Me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not because of us not coming to the studio and knew that we had to be there. It was that this one particular day we were at St. Stephen's Community Church and watching the Dixie Hummingbirds and Harmonizing Four, because we were very into gospel groups. And so the next day when we came up to the company, and they said, man, where were you guys? Mr. Gordy, he was looking for you all over town because he had to see a song for you guys. We said, well, we were at church. At church? And so we said, well, we were into spirituals, and we just had to watch those guys sing. He said, well, he gave the song to the Contours, and it was Do You Love Me.
I can't imagine the Temptations singing Do You Love Me. It's, you know, I know the Contours version so well.
Right.
Doesn't seem like the perfect song for the group. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess we'll never know now, because he wanted to try it out on us, and I think it would have been designed for Paul Williams. We had the chance to do the song, but I think the record went to number two, and we were kind of jealous, but we were happy for the Contours as well, because we felt that our time would come.
Otis Williams is my guest, the founder of the Temptations. Now, the first song that you had that really made it onto the charts, that crossed over onto the charts, was the way You Do the Things You Do. Now, this song was the result of a competition in-house, right?
Well, Barry always, like I stated in the book, he always had that competitiveness with his writers and his producers. You know, whoever would come up with the best product would get the release, and if they did it often enough, would get the most release, which would mean that you would make a lot of money. So Smokey had been writing, you know, and being very successful.
This is Smokey Robinson,
who was
your producer for a long time.
Right, and he had produced quite a few hits on Mary Wells. And when she left, that kind of opened up a little vacuum. So I guess he said, well, after writing My Guy, let me write My Girl. And so in 64, we recorded My Girl at the end of 64. And it was a big hit came February of 65.
Now, the way you do the things you do, Smokey Robinson also wrote that. Now, it's my understanding that there was a song competition of who would write. How did it work? Who would write the next song for the
Temptations?
Well,
that was later on. That was when Smokey had written Get Ready, and Norman Whitfield had written and produced Ain't Too Proud to Be. So now we had a string of hits with Smokey.
Uh-huh.
And Norman kept chipping away to the point that he really started coming up with very strong tracks. And he would have Eddie Holland of Holland, Doja Holland, to write the lyrics for him. So he really had a strong package there. So every Friday, Motown was noted for the thing of having a quality control meeting where they would bring all the material that was recorded that week. Well, that Friday, they would have like an evaluation of who would get the release and what did they think would be this and that and the yeas and nays. So with Smokey having so much success with us, Barry was kind of torn between, yeah, I like that Ain't Too Proud to Beg, but Smokey did have the hit on Ain't Too Proud to Beg. I mean, My Girl and Get Ready. So he said, here's what I do. If Get Ready, I'm going to go with Get Ready, and if it should go to the top 10, Smokey will get the next release. Now, if Get Ready didn't go to the top 10 nationally, Norman, you have the next release, because it Ain't Too Proud to Beg was so strong that it could not be denied any longer. So Get Ready must have gotten to the top 20, didn't crack the top 10. And so Norman came in there with Ain't Too Proud to Beg, and we had 7 years of hit-making with Norman Whitfield.
Okay, well, I want to play The Way You Do the Things You Do.
That's a good one.
Okay, and this was written by Smokey Robinson?
Yes, Smokey Robinson and Bobby Rogers.
The lead singer on this is Eddie Kendricks.
Eddie Kendricks.
And let's give it a listen, then we'll talk about the vocal harmonies.
You got a smile so bright. You know you could have been a candle. I'm holding you so tight. You know you could have been a hen. You know you could have been some perfume. Well, you could have been anything that you wanted to, and I can tell the way you do the things you do,
the way you do the
oh,
things
baby.
You do, the way you do the things you do,
as pretty as you are. You
know you could have been. Otis Williams, which part were you singing on that record?
I was singing baritone. We would always sit around with Smokey, and Smokey was a very good producer in the respect of he would already have in mind how he wanted the harmonies to be structured, who would sing, what lead, and what have you. So it really was never no problem working with Smokey, because he would say, okay, we knew Melvin would sing bass. Eddie was on lead. Paul, he sang second tenor. David did first, and I was baritone.
Did you used to work out the harmonies before you joined Motown?
No, we all would pitch in.
You were doing it together?
Yeah, because, you know, when you have five guys and everybody want their little voice to be heard about the creativeness, you would listen, and consequently, it would turn out to be very good, because like Richard, when we were at the distance, he was good at sitting around the piano and picking out notes, so, you know, we all put our little 2 cents in.
You describe how some of the producers would have the singers sing slightly above their range.
Yes, yes. Motown was noted for recording their songs like a step higher, because they wanted the tension, the vocal dynamics, the stressing point, the pleading sound. So when you would hear it, you could say, oh, wow, I feel what he's saying, like pain in the voice. They didn't want you to sing too relaxed, because the song wouldn't come across with that emotional outlet, that meaning where you could really feel it. So they would always cut the tunes, especially Norman and Holland and Doja Holland, would cut it a step higher, because that's the way Ain't Too Proud to Beg was recorded. It was recorded just a key too high for David, but he was able to do it, but it was not without us having to stop the tape and let him rest, because he was straining his vocal cords and his glasses were sliding all off his face and sweat was popping off. But we were, you know, just saying, go ahead, David, you can do it, you can do it. And it turned out to be one of our biggest sellers.
Now, did you have to be above your range also?
No, I didn't do that much leading in the songs that I did sing lead on. It was in the key, because I'm more or less a ballad person rather than the driving kind.
Okay. Otis Williams is my guest, and he's written an autobiography about his life forming and then singing with the Temptations. It's called Temptations. You described a little bit the competition between songwriters about who
right.
would get to write the next song for the group. Was there competition between the groups? Did you have to compete, say, with the Four Tops over who would get the song that you wanted to do?
No, because Barry never let that happen. He would always let, okay, Holland and Doja had the Supremes and the Four Tops, even though we really like what they were doing, speaking of Holland and Doja Holland. But he said, no, you guys are having too much success with Smokey Robinson or Norman Whitfield. And then he didn't want all the songs to start sounding alike, you know. So he wanted to always make sure that there was that division, that separate kind of identity. And so he would never let that happen, whereas Holland and Doja would just do, you know, more than what they should have done, and the sound would have become too saturated.
We got to talk about your choreography.
Okay.
The choreography for your group was done by Charlie Atkins, who was a great dancer and got his start like years before he started working with vocal groups,
mm-hmm.
Dancing with Honey Coles. And
absolutely.
So describe some of the steps that he choreographed for the Temptations and the names for the steps, too.
Well, actually, Charlie, like you said, from the Charlie Atkins, Cole and Atkins vaudeville days. We had checked him out a long time ago when he used to do Frankie Lyman, and he really did a wonderful job on the Cadillacs, because he brought the house down with the Cadillacs at the Fox Theater. And Charlie's steps, let me tell you something, not easy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I mean, he's got a lot of little hitch steps and, you know, a lot of little subtle movements, and you really have to pay a lot of attention, you know, because you look at the stuff that we do on stage, you say, that's easy. Oh, no, no, no. I mean, he's cussed us out and called us all kind of names, you know, because it would be hard to get, you know. But once you got a Charlie Atkins choreography down, you would definitely be separate and apart from any of the other acts, because his stuff is so unique that, you know, you just knew you had captured something very special, because he's not an easy fella to deal with as far as his choreography.
You said there were no extra beats for corrections when he was choreographing one of your songs. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, you had to learn it right then and there, because let's say if you got out of step, you would catch hell getting back in, because it's a lot of little hit steps, and he's got everything scientifically in place. So if you missed that and had to come back in, you said, oh, my God, am I going to catch back in? Because, you know, a lot of times choreography is to a certain kind of beat. Charlie would hear something that you would have to really strain to hear on the record, and he would probably pick up something like if it was a guitar lick. Well, most cases, steps are choreographed to the drum or bass lick. But he would get something that's all together, that's faint, that you would say, man, I don't even hear that. But it would be there. So if you didn't really grab hold of that and lost that step, it would take a minute to get back in. So it was very tedious in learning Charlie's routines. But like I said again, once you learn it, people would stand up and applaud because it was something really unique.
Did you ever lose it on stage?
Oh, yeah. All of us at one time or another.
How would you cover up?
Oh, we'd cover up. But somewhere along the way, after a while, you say, oh, no, I got to get back in. So you would find a way to get back in. It was just something inside you said, you better find a way. So you would find a way, but it would be hard. You would miss a few bars before you got back in step. So we would cover it up. We would clown a little bit. Oh, I'm right back to the bandstand to do that, and then come back up and, okay, I got it. Boop, and fall right in. But you would catch hell getting in for a while.
My guest is Otis Williams, and he's written an autobiography, and Otis Williams is the founder and leader of The Temptations. We'll hear more of their music and talk more about his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Otis Williams is my guest, and we're talking about founding and singing with The Temptations. And before we talk more about it, let's listen to another of The Temptations recordings. This is Since I Lost My Baby. You want to say anything about this before we hear?
This is one of my all-time favorites because the intro reminds me of a movie theme because it's so big, you know, and I really love the intro as well as the song.
And tell us what to listen to for your voice on here.
I am singing second tenor on this here. I'm singing right under Eddie. One of the things about the Temps, we are noted for being able to sing many different parts. Sometimes I sing baritone, second tenor, first tenor, aside from lead and lead. Never bass. That's exclusive to Melvin.
Okay, here we go. Since I Lost My Baby.
Plenty of light.
Oh,
a new
yeah.
day is dawning, sunny and bright.
Oh,
but
yeah.
after I've been crying all night, the sun is cold and the new day seems old. Since I lost my baby,
since I lost my baby.
Singing and the children are playing. There's plenty of work and the bosses are paying. Not a sad word should a young heart be saying.
What fun is a bore
and with money
I'm poor.
Since I lost my baby.
That's The Temptations. My guest is Otis Williams, the founder and leader of the group. That's one of your many records that crossed over R&B charts and pop charts. Barry Gordy really wanted the group to cross over. He was really into crossing
yes,
over.
Yes,
so were there things that he thought you should do to make sure you crossed over to the pop charts?
Well, he always stressed the thing of, like I said, lyrics, you know, had a large play in it. and song structure, but he also stressed that the melody would be very simple, you know, whereas, you know, even a child could hum it. So he would stress as simple as you could keep it, the more mass appeal it would have.
Well, there's certain things you're supposed to do, like for the white listeners.
Keep it simple.
Keep it simple for the white people.
Uh-huh. And for the black, but especially for, you know, that mass appeal. You know, just keep it like we said in the recording. I said it earlier today, and Joey and Suzanne, they died laughing. But when we are in the studio, sometimes you can get so sophisticated and carrying on with putting certain things together. So when we get to that point, we said, no, just K-I-S-S. And that means, in our term, keep it simple, stupid. Because most cases, when you look at the top 10, records basically are very simplistic, you know, and they have that mass appeal.
Well, I got the impression that the idea was that record buyers should be able to sing along with the song, so you
That's
didn't
it.
Want to do anything too complicated that we wouldn't be able to keep up with.
That was Barry's philosophy. That's it. You hit it dead on the head.
Let's talk about some of the problems with Motown and some of the problems within the group. When you signed your first contract with Motown, you were pretty young, in your teens or early 20s, I forget which.
Late teens, early 20s, yes. Mm-hmm.
Are there things that you shouldn't have signed that you did?
Well, at that time, you know, Motown being really the only game in town, so to speak, and we wanted to be there, you know. Barry had contracts that, let's say, now looking back on it, realizing the value of contracts and knowing the business like I do, those contracts weren't the best, you know. I mean, we were getting almost next to nothing in royalty rates and a 7-year contract, and they had everything. They took our name and all that stuff. So they weren't that great. They were geared for the protection of Motown, you know. So we signed it, and luckily, even though with those kind of contracts, we still made a large amount of money, you know. And so if they were like the contracts that we have today, my God, you know, it would have really even been better. But it was something that we had to grow to.
One of the problems internally in the group was when David Ruffin was doing a lot of the lead singing, you describe how he had a really big ego, and he wanted the group to be David Ruffin and the Temptations. He wanted his own limousine.
Yeah, well, he did have his own limousine, you know, because we, at the time, we had two limousines. David had his, then that was a group limousine. Then we had a station wagon, so it would be like a caravan of three when we travel. But there was a time that we had to meet down in Puerto Rico, and we had a meeting because he felt as though by him doing the lead, he should have it David Ruffin in the Temptations. So we all said, no, that couldn't be, because Eddie was singing lead, Paul was singing lead, Melvin was doing Old Man River, and my lead wasn't that much, but we just felt as though it should just stay that one word, Temptation. And so, yeah, ego, you know, we all had egos, I guess, with him being in the lead spot, you know, and, you know, being as fantastic as he, you know, is and was at that time, you know, he just felt as though he should have had that kind of, you know, distinction, and we just said no.
Well, he left the group, and Eddie Kendricks, the falsetto lead singer,
right.
left the group as well. Were there any conflicts ever between them over who should get more leads?
Not that I can recall, because, like I said, by and large, during that time, Smokey was our producer, and Smokey would always have in his mind who he wanted to lead his song. So it never got to be that. And when we started working with Norman would, in most cases, say, no, I want this and that guy. But then there were times we would say, hey, who would do it? But it never did get to be that kind of a conflict.
Let me play another Temptation song in which Eddie Kendricks and David Ruffin share the lead. This is You're My Everything.
You're My Everything.
Say something about it before we hear.
That was one of the tunes that I sang first tenor on. And Eddie said, oh, man, you can go and do it, because I was more comfortable singing second tenor and baritone. But Eddie was getting ready to sing lead. And we were saying, well, okay, now, hey, Eddie, if you sing a lead, who's going to do the first tenor part? You. Me. I said, man, I can't sing that. He said, man, I hear you hitting those high notes in canon. You can do it, Otis. And we got down there, and I did do it. And I think... No, it was another tune, but I started to say Paul missed the part on that, but he was there. It was Born to Love You that Paul wasn't on. But I ended up singing first tenor. I think Paul was singing second tenor, and David was up over me, and Melvin on bass.
Let's give it a listen. You're My Everything.
Surely about you. Honey, I couldn't live without you.
Temptations singing You're My Everything. Otis Williams, the founder of the group, is my guest. You have kept the group together after the leaving of the lead singers through the decades, through the psychedelic period, through funk. Have you ever had another thought cross your mind of doing something besides singing with the Temptations?
Well, there's other things I want to do, you know, but first and foremost, I like doing what I'm doing, being a member of the Temps and the challenges that we have been faced with and being able to, you know, ride them out, what have you. So I like what I do.
And just tell me, we only have a few seconds left. How is it different for you performing on stage now as a mature man as opposed to as a teenager and a young man when you started?
Well, it's not that much difference because you're still entertaining people, except they have grown with us. And, you know, you see a lot of the new generation, because when we were coming along in the 60s, and those that were following us now, they have kids, so they're bringing their kids to come see us. So it's that kind of difference, but we still get the adrenaline flow from seeing so many happy faces, and sometimes they are crying tears of joy. So it's still that electrifying feeling of performing to people of the world over. So it's still great 28 years later.
Otis Williams and the Temptations were recently inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Williams' autobiography is titled Temptations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time we talk about city life with William White. He spent the last 20 years observing people on the streets of New York to analyze how they use the city. Where some researchers see the city as unhealthy, overcrowded, and dangerous, White sees a vitality he wouldn't want to live without. His new book is called City, Rediscovering the Center. I hope you can join us.
Each day through my window, I watch her as she passes by. I say to myself, you're such a lucky guy to have a girl like her. It's truly a dream.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When photographer Robert Adams looks at the American West, he's torn between anger at man's destruction and awe at the beauty that's still undisturbed. Coming up, Robert Adams tells about balancing those two emotions in his images of the West. You may not believe this, but there was a time when our rock historian Ed Ward got tired of rock and roll. Coming up, Ed tells how in the 60s, the vocal group The Manhattans brought him back into the fold. And book critic John Leonard reviews Billy Bathgate, E.L. Doctorow's new novel about a young man coming of age in the mob. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The Iran-Contra trial of Oliver North began today in Washington with opening statements to the jury. Details from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
Prosecutor John Kecker portrayed North as a man who profited personally from his schemes, a man who would lie to anyone to cover up his illegal activities in support of the Contras. On one occasion, said the prosecutor, North looked the members of the House Intelligence Committee in the eye, and he lied. On another, he looked the Attorney General in the eye, and he lied. The evidence will show, said Kecker, that when the time came for Oliver North to tell the truth, he lied. When the time came for Oliver North to come clean, he shredded and altered documents. When the time came for Oliver North to let the light in, he covered up. But defense lawyer Brendan Sullivan said North had only been acting to carry out the orders of President Reagan and other high officials of government. Over and over, Sullivan said, that North's actions were not North's idea, but the president's. And you will see, said lawyer Sullivan, his voice a dramatic whisper, that in the end, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North has been abandoned by his government. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
President Bush today called for quick Senate confirmation of John Tower as Secretary of Defense. Bush said the latest FBI report on Tower has gunned down the charges against the former Texas senator. At a White House news conference, the president also condemned the Ayatollah Khomeini's call for the murder of author Salman Rushdie as offensive to the norms of civilized behavior. The president said he supports the European community's decision to withdraw Western diplomats from Iran. President Bush leaves Washington for East Asia tomorrow. The trip will take him to Japan for the funeral of Emperor Hirohito. From there, the president travels to China and South Korea. NPR's Ted Clark reports the president will try to pack a great deal of diplomacy into just 6 days.
The trip is intended to highlight the importance of U.S. ties to Japan, China, and South Korea. But Mr. Bush will be thinking about U.S. ties to many other countries as well. Leaders from all over the world will be in Tokyo for the funeral, and the president is tentatively scheduled to meet individually with the presidents of Egypt, Israel, France, West Germany, Nigeria, and Brazil, as well as the prime ministers of Pakistan, Singapore, Thailand, and Turkey, and the kings of Jordan and Belgium, and other names may be added to the list. President Bush will spend 15 to 30 minutes with each. Brent Scowcroft, the president's national security advisor, said today, "The personal contact provided by such meetings eases the sense of communication between the U.S. and other nations." Asked whether the president may have piled on too many meetings, Scowcroft said, "It remains to be seen," adding that the president wanted to take advantage of the trip to do a number of substantive things. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Soviet Foreign Minister Edvard Shevardnadze is in Cairo trying to overcome the chief obstacle to a Middle East peace drive, Israeli opposition to an international peace conference. The issue was the focus of a second meeting today between Shevardnadze and the Egyptian foreign minister. Shevardnadze has also scheduled separate meetings tomorrow with Israeli Foreign Minister Moshe Arens and PLO leader Yasser Arafat. El Salvador's leftist rebels today offered to lay down their weapons if the government agrees to three main proposals: cuts in the armed forces, reorganization of police forces, and postponement of next month's presidential elections by at least 4 months. The rebels presented their revised plan on the second day of talks in Mexico with delegates from 13 Salvadoran political parties. Congressman Bill Grant of Florida today announced he has switched his party affiliation from Democrat to Republican. Grant, who easily won election twice as a Democrat, says his switch is not going to change his values or the way he votes. Stock prices closed mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained just over a point to close at 2326.43, but declines led advances 8-5 on volume of 143 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The vocal group The Manhattans has endured through decades of changing trends in pop music. While other musicians changed chorus to hook into disco or rap, The Manhattans kept true to the spirit and harmonies of their doo-wop roots. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says the group holds a special place in his heart because of songs like Manhattan Stomp.
Tell me where did you learn how to do that dance? Do, 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 do. I wanna try it, cause I might buy it. I like that dance. I love the way you slide around and stomp your feet. Trying, if I don't learn it, I lose my mind. Whoa, 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 whoa,
Manhattan Stomp.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
I'm here to tell you, folks, the Manhattans brought me back. In 1965, I'd just graduated from high school and had a job in a summer camp kitchen where I was the only white employee. My fellow workers were all from South Carolina, and I'm happy to say that they were very musically open-minded. They really liked Bob Dylan, and maybe to thank me for that discovery, they turned me on to what they were listening to, stuff I'd been completely unaware of, like Cannonball Adderley, The Temptations, and especially The Manhattans.
Has anybody seen?
See my baby sister. She ran away.
I've been so lonesome.
We need each and every day.
I'm tired of searching.
Searching east and west and all over town.
Will somebody please
tell me where my baby can be found?
Searching for My Baby was the record that made me want to listen to rock and roll again. I'd given up a few years earlier as the raw energy of the 50s faded into the wimpdom of the early 60s, and as a result, I'd missed such developments as the rise of Motown and the Rolling Stones. No matter, in this record I heard a perfect combination of the old doo-wop vocal group sound and something new and fresh. As well I should have. The Manhattans had their genesis in the doo-wop era. Blue Lovett and Kenneth Kelly, the two founding members, had been lead singers in rival groups in Jersey City. But when they discovered Smitty Smith, they both willingly took the back seat. Here was a great voice.
You know the bees need a little honey. Yes, they do. Just like 2 and 2 has got to make 4. Baby, I need you. Baby, I need you.
Signed to a Newark record company, Carnival, the Manhattans elevated the label out of obscurity between 1964 and 1968 with great songs like this Blue Lovett composition.
I wanna be your lover.
I Wanna Be Your Everything sold 500,000 copies, and this in a time when Motown virtually ruled the black pop charts. But the Manhattans brought in 8 top 40 hits for Carnival nonetheless. Quality always shows. In 1968, they signed with another label, Deluxe, possibly because Carnival was in trouble financially. And although their first couple of singles barely charted, it was downhill from there. In 1970, Smitty Smith suddenly developed spinal meningitis and died, and it looked like the end of another legendary vocal group. But it's a showbiz truism that black audiences never really forget, and there was work for the Manhattans if they wanted it. They found a new lead singer, Gerald Alston, and he was spectacular. So spectacular, in fact, that Columbia Records picked them up right away.
Baby, you are my life, and without you, I'm an empty shell. There's no house without a home. Wants to be alone. There's no child without a dream. And there's no song without a meaning.
That's how I know.
There's No Me Without You became a smash in 1973 and revived a career that saw the Manhattans selling many times the number of records they had a decade earlier, a smooth oasis in the middle of the disco era. They're still at it. Where Did We Go Wrong was a hit in 1987, and Gerald Alston's just put out a solo album with an Eagles song on it, of all things, on Motown Records. I suspect there will always be a place for the Manhattan sound among black audiences. I know there is on my turntable. Like I said, they brought me back.
Honey, you are my shining star. Don't you go away. Oh, baby, wanna be right here where you are until the dying day. Yeah, baby. So many have tried to find a love like yours and mine.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. In the early 60s, after getting a Ph.D. in English from the University of Southern California, Robert Adams returned home to Colorado to teach. But the land was so changed by development and the population explosion that he was compelled to pick up a camera. He began to show his photographs in the early 70s and has been photographing the changing Western landscape ever since. A major exhibition of his work has been mounted by the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Aperture has published the catalog to the exhibit called To Make It Home. In the catalog, Adams wrote, quote, "Developers destroy places where we became and would like to continue to become ourselves," unquote. I asked him if there was such a place in his past.
To be completely specific, there was a place called Ann Evans Lookout, about 20 miles west in the mountains of Denver, where my family used to go and picnic, and I camped there through my early years. It was a wonderful lookout from which you could see a 14,000-foot peak across a grand valley 8 miles across. Subsequently, I went back years after that and discovered that apparently the Forest Service had sold off the area to private holders, and now all I was looking at was a chain-link fence and Dobermans. It's fairly typical of what happened during the 60s and 70s in Colorado.
So how have you taken your cue from that as a photographer?
The thing that I finally decided I wanted to try to do as a photographer was to do really two things. I wanted to be as accurate as I could about the disappearance of the Old West and tell as truthfully as I could the story of the damage that we've done and are continuing to accomplish. Together with that, however, I wanted to make a record of the things that had not changed. It seemed to me it was worth doing both those things, because if you're not honest about the damage, you're just a sentimentalist. But if all you do is talk about the damage, you take away people's hope. And what I would really like to accomplish is to give us an impetus to keep trying. It's never all right to give up.
Some of your photographs are of vast open spaces and beautiful open sky. And you quote Walt Whitman. You quote him as writing, "Overhead, one of those not uncommon yet indescribable skies."
It's absolutely true. Nabokov wrote somewhere that the sky in central Russia, he'd only seen that sky one other place in the world, and that was in Colorado. And there are still days like that.
Well, you don't have to find the words to describe the not uncommon yet indescribable sky, but you had to figure out how to photograph it so that it does the sky justice. What are some of the concerns that you have as a photographer, and what are some of the challenges of getting a beautiful picture showing the sky? And I should mention here, the photographs I've seen of yours are in black and white.
It's true. I prefer black and white. I think the reason being that it allows you a greater degree of abstraction, and the other color photography gives up that power, which I think is too much of a thing to give away. There are just wonderful moments in the West when, in the afternoon, for example, off the Rockies often come in the summer these great towering thunderheads, and they move slowly eastward. And those can be just riveting to watch, and of course composing as those things, they move very quickly, and it's sometimes you can get done with a couple of hours of working with that, and you can just be weak from exhaustion because the possibilities are so exciting. On the other hand, there is a challenge to photographing just an empty sky. That's a lot harder to do, really. Clouds are a wonderful sort of music that it's great to work with, but it's sometimes too easy.
So how do you do it when there's no cloud?
Then you have to do something, obviously, with the ground, and I can't really tell you how you do it. It just you have to make something in that rectangle so that the great expanse that's empty is necessary to whatever's down below. So it's in large measure a question of trying to be open enough to new subjects and be, of course, good enough at your craft to record what you want to record, and that takes a while, of course.
One thing I think that you've been trying to do with your photographs is to document the exploitation of the prairie and of the mountains.
We've turned everything to use. I'm a socialist, and I don't think the West is going to survive, frankly, in any significant way in the capitalist system, because it doesn't pay to have it survive. Everything can be sold, and it will be sold. It's very sad.
Well, you have one photograph of just an open expanse of land, and there's a little for sale or lease sign
yeah,
on it.
Right. It's amazing. But the real question, though, is what are we to make of this? How are we to keep from becoming just hopelessly depressed by it? And in a measure, I think art helps. It reminds us of those moments that we all have and then all forget, that suggest that the world is still whole despite the ways we've harmed it. But that really is the effort to admit that these things are going on, and nonetheless to find a way still to like life.
It seems to me you have really worked very hard at trying to not be very bitter, or at least to not be overcome by bitterness at how the West is changing.
That's the real issue to me personally. One of Godard's films in the 60s, Le Petit Soldat, I think ends with the protagonist saying something like, the only thing left is to learn not to be bitter. And in a personal way, I think that is a large part of the issue. Some critic wrote of Philip Levine's poetry that it expressed a constructive bitterness. And short of wisdom, I suppose that's what I'm trying to achieve. Wisdom would be better, of course. One would like to be able to oppose these things that are wrong and then get to the end of the day and be peaceful and accept what has to be accepted and forgiving of what should be forgiven.
You've taken some photographs of vandalism of nature. Now, being an urban dweller, I see vandalism of buildings and subways all the time. But these are pictures of rocks and canyons with graffiti on them.
Yeah, and it's even sometimes more ominous than that. I found myself near Fontana, California once, walking rows of old eucalyptus trees, and almost every one of them had been hit head high with shotgun blasts. But why head high? I kept asking myself. What are they trying to say by this? And it reminded me of how often trees do seem like people. And it was terribly frightening.
Why do you think the trees were shot?
I think in a way because they were like people. Because whoever it was with that shotgun was so full of disgust and hate and despair. And that's really what art is about, I think. It's trying to speak to that condition, admitting that there's some justification for discouragement, but trying to suggest that there's a way to sweeten the attitude a little bit.
When you're taking photographs of the beauty that remains in the West, the natural beauty that has remained, how do you go looking for it? Do you take special photography trips just to look for
It's interesting how one finds photographs. theoretically you think you drive along and you'd see something and stop and take a picture. But in fact, what I found is that you can't take a picture unless you're walking. So a car isn't any good except it kind of gets you in the general neck of the woods, and then you just walk. And the thing that tips you off finally that there's a picture there is it doesn't have anything to do at that point really with philosophy. It's just a fascination with how wonderful that particular scene or object is. A photographer really has to stay open just to the joy of a very particular discovery. And if you're blessed, why, that discovery may turn out to have reverberations out from it and maybe some metaphoric content. But basically, you've got to just love the particular place or tree or stream or whatever.
Thank you very much for talking with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
To Make It Home, an exhibit of photographs of the American West by Robert Adams, is currently on exhibit at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. From there, the show travels to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, the Corcoran Gallery in Washington, D.C., the Ammon Carter Museum in Fort Worth, and the Colorado History Museum in Denver. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Noah, what's coming up?
Well, as you might have expected, the Oliver North trial gets underway here in Washington at long last. Also, difficulties continue around the world for the author Salman Rushdie. The death threats from Iran, of course, and difficulties continuing for booksellers around the world, whether or not to stop selling the Rushdie book, if indeed they actually can get it. We'll talk with the owner of a store in St. Paul who says it is the obligation of a bookseller to present the books that are most interesting, but he's sold out. Also, a conversation with Jesse White, the veteran actor surely best known for a role he's leaving. He's filmed his last commercial as the lonely Maytag repairman.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. E.L. Doctorow is one of the leading practitioners of a form of fiction that uses real historical events and personalities alongside imagined ones. His books include Ragtime, The Book of Daniel, and World's Fair. Doctorow's latest novel, Billy Bathgate, is a journey into New York's criminal underworld in the year 1935. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
I hate to deconstruct an act of magic, but here's what Billy Bathgate is about. It's about a sort of Horatio Alger, apprenticed to gangsters, and American capitalism, which is, for E.L. Doctorow, just a higher form of gangsterism, and the American system of social classes, for which money is both a solvent and a whistling in the dark, and the immigrant's romance with the popular culture of his adopted country, and gamblers, and orphans, and New York, and the Great Depression. It's another Great Gatsby, and a fairy tale, like Galahad, like Rapunzel. It's all of these snared in a net of smoke, swords, moonbeams, sea sweat, and blood threads, a language of the deepest chords that swells and trembles, refines and purifies, makes new and permanent. There is nothing Doctorow can't write about with surpassing grace: love, death, sex, money, horses, and the Bronx. He makes up whole worlds out of words. Just listen to Dutch Schultz die. He is the gangster to whom 16-year-old Billy has apprenticed himself. And Dutch has been shot, and as he dies babbling, an older Billy thinks, quote, "And while this monologue of his own murder is a cryptic passion, it is not poetry. The fact is he lived as a gangster and spoke as a gangster. And when he died, bleeding from the sutured holes in his chest, he died of the gangsterdom of his mind as it flowed from him. He died dispensing himself in utterance, as if death is chattered out being, as if all we are made of is words, and when we die, the soul of speech decants itself into the universe." Dutch dies, essentially, because he can't evolve from the first stage of capitalism, primitive accumulation by distortion, murder, and the numbers racket, to the next stages, which are monopoly and the modern corporation of Lucky Luciano and the mob. Billy, who first attracted Dutch's attention on the street by juggling two balls, a navel orange, an egg, and a stone, spends a season with his gang as a busboy, bagman, go-between, and spy. He's there for the assassination by tugboat and cement boots of disloyal Beau Weinberg, and the kidnap of Beau's upper-class inamorata, the young and fair Miss Preston. He hides out with the rest of them, upstate among mortgage foreclosures, till Dutch is tried for income tax evasion, and helps plan a hit on District Attorney Tom Dewey, and barely escapes the massacre at the Palace Chop House in Newark, New Jersey, October 23, 1935. As in any good fairy tale, Billy will climb a dark tower and wear a magic cloak. He'll find the buried treasure and rescue the princess. There's a mad mother and an evil wizard. There's even, and this is the one bad idea in an otherwise brilliant book, a baby in a basket. Billy then achieves a wider world of lawyers and bankers and Ivy League crooks and Dutch Hitlers, a world, quote, of even greater circles of gangsterdom than I had dreamed, latitudes and longitudes of gangsterdom. But he takes the Bronx with him, as a compass, as a seasoning. To the radical politics of his earlier novel, The Book of Daniel, and the revisionist history of ragtime, Doctorow has added a transcending poetry and passion. Billy Bathgate is superb.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Billy Bathgate by E.L. Doctorow. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we talk with jazz memoirist, poet, and novelist Al Young. His new novel, Seduction by Light, follows a black actress forced to live a role she played in the movies, a maid in a white household. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two recordings conducted by the late Sir Thomas Beecham. And commentator Leslie Savin looks at glasnost in TV commercials. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton, Ed Doherty, and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burden directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.